You're here because you want the smart scoop, the core insights, without getting lost in a mountain of information.
Exactly.
That's the deep dive in a nutshell. Think of us as your shortcut to being seriously well-informed.
And today, we've got a really compelling mission lined up. We're focusing on a first-hand account. It's episode 59 from the Military Tales YouTube channel featuring Steve Umland.
Right.
He's basically taking us behind the curtain into Task Force Alpha during the Vietnam War.
Yeah, forget the standard war stories you might have heard. This is noop dive stuff, top secret intelligence operations. So secret, the story goes, and Umland mentions this, that even the pilots flying into the base were blindfolded.
Wow.
I mean, that kind of detail just grabs you, right?
It really does. And Task Force Alpha, its objective was absolutely vital. They were monitoring the Ho Chi Minh Trail in Laos,
yeah,
using some pretty advanced sensor technology for the time.
And this trail, it wasn't just some path, was it?
Oh, no, not at all. You have to picture this vast network of roads, tracks, paths. It was the logistical lifeline for North Vietnam. Understanding the flow of supplies and troops down that trail was critical.
Okay. And our guide into this hidden world is Steve Umland. He was, what, a young Air Force guy?
Yeah, just a young, enlistee, newly trained in photo interpretation, who kind of unexpectedly found himself right at the heart of this incredibly classified operation.
All right, so let's unpack that. How does a young guy, maybe not a star student by his own admission, end up in a super secret intel unit like this?
Well, it's quite a story he tells in episode 59. He says he wasn't great academically, but then he took the Air Force aptitude test and just aced it. He scored so high, he apparently still wonders if maybe they mixed up his results or something. And that score, that surprising result, it led him to choose Air Force intelligence. He said the other option was air traffic control, but he went with intel.
A pretty fateful choice, it sounds like.
Definitely.
Mm-hmm.
So this test score lands him in photo interpretation training, specialized stuff.
Right, PI school. Where was that?
At Lowry Air Force Base in Denver. And by the time he's barely 20 years old, he gets these orders, sort of vague orders, really, for Southeast Asia.
Okay.
They routed him through Bangkok, then to Nakhon Phanom in Thailand. NKP, they called it. And that's where he was assigned to this, well, mysterious Task Force Alpha.
And mysterious is the word, right? Because he says when he got there, late 69, nobody seemed to know what it actually was.
Exactly. Super compartmentalized. He arrives, he's living in a tent initially, just trying to figure things out. And then, almost unbelievably, Bob Hope shows up.
Bob Hope, like the Bob Hope.
The Bob Hope. Comes for a USO show visit in December 69. And Sandlin recounts this anecdote where Hope is joking on stage about the base being so secret.
Don't tell me.
That they had to blindfold the pilots flying in.
There it is, that story again.
It really underscores the level of secrecy they were dealing with. It's not just hearsay, it was apparently even a joke at the time.
Wild. So, okay, blindfolded pilots, maybe, maybe not, but definitely intense secrecy. What was the actual mission once they were on the ground there?
Well, the core mission, and Raytheon lays this out clearly in episode 59, was this continuous 247 monitoring of the Ho Chi Minh Trail.
Okay.
This became incredibly important after the Tet Offensive in 68, which kind of brutally exposed how little was really known about North Vietnamese movements and logistics. Task Force Alpha was created specifically to fill that intelligence gap.
And again, we're talking about a huge area, this trail network.
Massive. Dreeline describes it starting up in North Vietnam, coming through the Mujia Pass, and then just fanning out, branching in all these different directions through Laos. It wasn't one single road at all.
So how on earth do you monitor something like that?
Technology. Really advanced tech for the late 60s, these F-4 Phantoms, fighter jets, to drop sensors all along the suspected route.
Sensors? Like listening devices?
Sort of, yeah. Over 20,000 of them, apparently. These little ground sensors. They had a limited lifespan, maybe around 2 weeks or so.
20,000 sensors? That's, that's a lot. What could they actually pick up? You called it Star Wars-esque earlier.
Yeah, I mean, Umland describes it that way, and it sounds like it. These weren't just simple microphones. They could apparently detect truck movement.
Okay.
But not just that there was a truck. They could get data suggesting its speed, maybe even the gear it was in, its estimated weight based on seismic signature, perhaps.
You're kidding.
No. And they could also detect personnel movement. They could somehow differentiate, maybe count the number of soldiers passing, or even detect bicycles loaded down with supplies, like bags of rice. It's a pretty incredible detail they were aiming for.
Tiny electronic ears scattered all over the jungle. Unbelievable. So all the sensor data is flooding in.
Yeah.
Where does it go? What happens next?
It fed into what Humland calls the war room. And his description makes it sound straight out of, well, Star Wars or Doctor Strangelove.
Okay, paint the picture.
There was this huge illuminated display panel. On it were these strings, basically lines representing different segments of the Ho Chi Minh Trail Network.
Right.
And little lights would move along these strings, showing the real-time or near-real-time movement detected by the sensors' vehicles, personnel.
So you could literally watch convoys moving on a map.
That was the idea. And if they saw a significant concentration, say a bunch of trucks detected moving into a specific area and stopping,
then you try and find them.
Exactly. That's the next step. Pinpoint their location.
Which is where the photo interpreters, like Umland, come back in, using planes to take pictures.
Precisely. They'd task aerial reconnaissance flights to photograph the specific grid coordinates where the sensors indicated activity. But, and this was a huge challenge.
The jungle canopy.
Right, dense jungle. Mm. The North Vietnamese were masters of camouflage, hiding the roads, hiding vehicles, hiding supply dumps.
Then he had other tricks too, right? Tunnels.
Oh yeah, extensive tunnel systems. Umland mentions a name, possibly V.R. Vons. He wasn't sure on the spelling. But these were like underground depots or stations for vehicles and supplies.
So they could just drive underground?
Essentially, yes. Drive in, be completely hidden from aerial view, protected from bombing to some extent. It made finding targets incredibly difficult.
Plus they had heavy equipment too, didn't they? It wasn't just basic stuff.
No. Ruzan mentions they even had bulldozers for road maintenance and repair. They were running a sophisticated logistical operation. And rivers too, if a bridge was bombed.
They'd just find another way across.
Quickly. They'd set up fords, underwater bridges sometimes, just ways to keep the traffic moving. After a strike, Task Force Alpha would do BDA bomb damage assessment.
Taking photos to see if the bombs hit, how bad the damage was.
Exactly. And crucially, how quickly the enemy got things moving again. It was this constant cycle, this sort of technological cat and mouse game.
Yuzlin shares some specific stories in that episode 59 recording that really bring this work to life. Tell us about the one with Staff Sergeant Neuspickel.
Right. This is a great example of how important the human element still was, despite all the tech. So Neuspickel is at a light table looking at reconnaissance film. He's using stereo pairs.
Stereo, yeah. Like 3D.
Exactly. Two overlapping photos viewed through a stereoscope, which lets the interpreter see the terrain in three dimensions, how spot things hidden under trees, subtle shapes. He was also using infrared film.
Which shows heat signatures.
Correct. So Pickel spots something under this really dense canopy. It's not obvious, but his experience tells him it looks like trucks, maybe concealed trucks.
Just a gut feeling almost.
Based on expertise, yeah. Subtle clues. He flags it, convinces the captain it's worth checking out. They authorize an airstrike based on his interpretation.
Ah.
Boom. Turns out it was a massive fuel depot. It burned, Umland says, for 3 solid days.
Wow. Just from spotting some shadows on a photo. Incredible.
It really highlights the skill involved. It wasn't just about the sensors. It was about interpreting the visual intelligence, too.
And Umland himself had a big find, too, right? Identifying an anti-aircraft site.
He did. And this is when he was still relatively new. He spotted this camouflage pit, saw what looked like tunnels leading off it towards gun emplacements. He used the reference manuals, the keys.
To identify the type of weapon.
Yes. And he identified it as a radar-controlled anti-aircraft battery. Pretty serious threat. But initially, his report was kind of met with skepticism. Maybe because he was new, maybe they didn't think it was there.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. But then, just a few days later, an OB-10 Bronco reconnaissance plane was flying near that area. Searly got shot down, came back with holes in it. The pilot confirmed, yep, there was heavy, accurate anti-aircraft fire coming from that exact spot. Had identified.
Vindication for Umland, I guess, but terrifying for that pilot.
Absolutely. A stark reminder of how high the stakes were with this intelligence work.
Planet also brings up something else in episode 59, a connection to the Paris Peace Accords. How did that fit in?
Well, this adds another layer of complexity, maybe even politics, to the intelligence picture. Planet recalls the period when bombing was supposedly halted over North Vietnam as part of the peace talks.
Right.
But there was this condition, apparently. No deployment of new surface-to-air missiles, SAMs, or radar-controlled AA guns by the North Vietnamese.
Aww.
So the implication Umland raises is that there might have been pressure, perhaps, not to report finding such systems, even if they were technically in Laos along the trail, because it could potentially derail the peace talks.
So intelligence might have been suppressed for political reasons, even if it meant danger to pilots.
That's the uncomfortable possibility he touches upon. It must have been incredibly frustrating for the intel folks, knowing the threats were there, but potentially facing constraints on reporting them fully.
Yeah, you can imagine. He also mentions this disputed figure about the sheer volume of bombs dropped on the trail.
Yes, he'd researched it and found figures suggesting more bombs were dropped on the Ho Chi Minh trail network than in all of World War II and the Korean War combined. He said he wasn't allowed to publish that figure in an article later.
Whether the exact figure is right or not, it speaks to the sheer scale of the air effort against the trail.
Absolutely. And he also recounts these moments during temporary bombing halts, seeing imagery of North Vietnamese truck convoys just lined up, waiting right at the Laotian border.
Just waiting for the halt to end so they could drive south.
Exactly. Waiting for darkness, waiting for the all clear. It really highlights the relentlessness of the enemy's logistical effort and the immense challenge Task Force Alpha faced trying to stop it.
So considering everything, the tech, the cost, the challenges, how effective was Task Force Alpha ultimately?
That's the million-dollar question, or rather the billion-dollar question. Lamlin mentions the cost was staggering, maybe $1 billion a year back then.
$1 billion a year, wow.
Huge investment. Now, was it worth it? Lamlin personally felt it was. He believed that even stopping one truck, one bag of rice, potentially saved lives, so it had value.
But he also pointed out a major problem, didn't he? Communication.
Yes, this seems to be a key point in his account. He felt there was often poor communication, a disconnect between the intelligence gathered at Task Force Alpha and the actual pilots flying the strike missions out of Nakhon Phanom.
How could that happen? They were right there.
It sounds like bureaucracy, maybe. The intelligence often had to go way up the chain, maybe to Saigon, 7th Air Force headquarters, sometimes even involving the U.S. ambassador to Laos.
Before it got back down to the pilots who needed it.
Potentially, yes. And in that kind of dynamic environment, that delay could make the intelligence useless. Targets move.
So a critical flaw in the system, potentially.
It seems like it could have been, though he does mention something called the Scat Pack.
Scat Pack? What was that?
Apparently, it involved using unmarked L-23 Learjets, small, fast jets, for rapid delivery of reconnaissance film. So there were attempts to speed things up, at least for getting the raw imagery processed quickly.
Unmarked jets. Adds to the whole clandestine feel, doesn't it?
Totally. And he briefly touches on other shadowy operations in the area, too, like CIA activities.
Heavy hook, he called it.
Yeah, heavy hook.
Oh.
CIA program run out of Vientiane, apparently inserting ground recon teams, indigenous teams probably, right onto the trail itself to get eyes on intelligence. Holland suspected some of the helicopters based at NKP might have been supporting those insertions and extractions. And he mentions SOG, too.
Studies and Observations Group. The special ops guy is running cross-border missions.
Right. Highly classified operations into Laos and Cambodia.
Yeah.
Holland wasn't directly involved, but it paints a picture of just how much was going on in that seemingly quiet border region. Multiple layers of secret operations.
Okay, so after all this intense work at Task Force Alpha, Holland gets transferred. Where did he go next?
He gets transferred to Yokota Air Base in Japan,
yeah.
Assigned to the 67th Reconnaissance Tactical Squadron, or RTS.
And that sounds important.
Oh, very prestigious. They're the unit processing imagery from the SR-71 Blackbird spy plane flights.
The fastest plane in the world, flying incredibly high.
Exactly. Flying missions over Southeast Asia, but also China, North Korea, getting imagery from places no other aircraft could reach.
Yeah.
Vonnegut himself seemed surprised by the transfer, which suggests his work at Task Force Alpha was highly valued.
And if Task Force Alpha was secret, the 67th RTS sounds like it was on another level entirely. He tells that Green Door story.
Right. Apparently, the main operations center for the 67th was behind this literal green door, and the security was so tight that even the Yokota base commander wasn't cleared to know exactly what they did in there.
Incredible compartmentalization.
Absolutely. Total need-to-know basis.
So, Umlin, with his photo interpretation skills honed at Task Force Alpha, finds himself at Yokota looking at SR-71 imagery. And this leads him to get involved in the intelligence for the Sante prison raid.
Correct. A very famous, or perhaps infamous, special operations mission. His role was specifically analyzing the SR-71 imagery of the Sante prison camp, which was believed to hold dozens of American POWs not far from Hanoi.
And the tech had evolved even further by then.
It seems so. He mentions that by late 69, they were getting computer printouts that flagged potential areas of interest on the SR-71 film as it was being processed, frame by frame.
Speeding things up. But even with that, Omlin's interpretation of those images caused some friction, didn't it?
That's a critical part of his account in episode 59. He looked closely at the imagery. Very high resolution stuff from the SR-71. He analyzed patterns, particularly the grass within the compound.
Grass?
Yeah, like, was it worn down in paths, suggesting regular movement, or was it overgrown? And crucially, he noticed a complete lack of bicycle tracks or movement.
Ride bicycles.
Bicycles were ubiquitous in Vietnam, he points out, for transport, everything. Even in prison camps, you'd expect some level of activity, some tracks. He saw none.
So based on the grass and the lack of bikes?
He concluded the camp was likely empty, abandoned.
But that went against the official intelligence estimate.
Completely. The official line was still that over 50 POWs were there. Winland said he even asked to review older imagery to see if there had been activity before, but that request was denied.
Hmm. Did he push his analysis?
He stuck by it, drawing on everything he'd learned about interpreting subtle signs of activity. But he also mentioned getting a distinct feeling that the decision to launch the raid, it had kind of already been made, regardless of his analysis.
And tragically, his analysis turned out to be right.
Yes. The raid went ahead. Mm. Highly skilled special forces team, complex night helicopter assault.
Mm-hmm.
They hit the camp perfectly. Mm. No prisoners. It was empty. Just as intelligence suspected.
Devastating.
He describes the mood in the intelligence room when the radio call came back. Negative items. Meaning no prisoners found. Just silence. All that planning, risk, one aircraft lost, injuries for an empty objective.
So what happened? When were the prisoners moved? Why?
That remains unclear, really. Pellin mentions theories. Maybe a nearby river flooded the camp. Maybe the well dried up, forcing a move. Or maybe they were moved well before his analysis and earlier intelligence just hadn't caught up.
He also pushes back a bit on who did the main analysis, right? Saying it wasn't just the DIA.
Yeah, he disputes the idea sometimes put forth that the Defense Intelligence Agency did the primary photo analysis. He emphasizes that the 67th RTS interpreters did a thorough job with the SR-71 imagery they had.
It sounds like a situation ripe for second-guessing and finger-pointing after the fact.
Definitely. He even shares an anecdote about how some personnel at the 67th had actually figured out the likely target of the mission beforehand just by piecing together clues and got reprimanded for potentially compromising security.
Wow. And there were rumors of leaks, too, a mole in Saigon.
He mentions those rumors, yeah. Whether true or not, it just adds to the fog of war and the challenges of intelligence.
Yeah.
Interestingly, though, he notes there was zero North Vietnamese MiG fighter activity during the raid itself.
Suggesting they were caught by surprise.
It certainly suggests they weren't expecting it, despite any potential leaks or deductions. He also laments a missed opportunity in SR-71 flight just days before the raid had a mechanical issue, and the film couldn't be processed immediately because a few personnel cleared for that specific mission weren't available. Crucial, timely intel might have been lost.
So despite finding no prisoners, Milan refers to Sante as a successful failure. How can a mission like that be considered successful in any way?
Well, he explains two main points based on debriefs of POWs who were eventually released. First, even though the raid failed to rescue anyone at Sante, news of the attempt spread through the POW network in North Vietnam.
And that helped morale.
Immensely. It showed the prisoners that they hadn't been forgotten, that America cared enough to mount a complex, risky operation deep inside enemy territory just to try and get them out. That was a huge psychological boost.
Okay, I can see that. What was the second point?
The raid spooked the North Vietnamese. In response, they decided to consolidate most of the scattered American POWs into fewer, larger camps, primarily the infamous Hanoi Hilton.
How was that a success?
Ironically, it meant prisoners who had been held in isolation or small groups were now together with many more countrymen. This improved communication, organization, mutual support, and overall camaraderie and morale among the POWs significantly. So, unintended positive consequences.
That's fascinating. A mission fails its objective, but ends up improving the situation for the very people it was trying to help, just in a different way.
Exactly. A complex outcome.
Manlin also talks about search and rescue, SAR missions. Task Force Alpha played a role there, too.
A crucial one, he emphasizes. Whenever an American aircraft went down in their area of operations, Task Force Alpha would immediately drop its primary mission, monitoring the trail, and dedicate its resources to supporting the SAR effort.
How would they help?
Using their aerial imagery, they'd try to map out the immediate terrain around the crash site, identify potential escape routes for the downed pilot, locate enemy positions that might threaten the rescue forces.
Trying to guide the rescuers and the evader?
Essentially, yes. Providing intelligence picture for the SAR commanders. He mentions the famous Bat 21 rescue, although he arrived just before that specific massive operation kicked off. He also talks about pilots using coded signals and the constant danger of the North Vietnamese setting ambushes for rescue helicopters.
It sounds incredibly dangerous for everyone involved. Did Lin feel the information transfer was better during SAR operations?
He expresses some uncertainty about whether he was directly telling people on the ground where to go, but his overall feeling, which seems consistent, was that information flow during the war often felt inadequate or inefficient.
That breakdown in communication again, a recurring theme.
It seems so. Having the intelligence is one thing. Getting it to the right people at the right time to act on it is another challenge entirely.
So looking back on his whole experience, Task Force Alpha, the 67th, Santiv Shiv, what's Umlin's overall takeaway from his military service as he shares it in episode 59?
Despite admitting he wasn't always a fan of the military regimentation, the discipline side of things, he expresses real pride in his service, pride in the work they did, the contribution he made, particularly in these highly demanding, highly secret intelligence roles. He clearly felt it was important work.
It certainly sounds like it. Steve Umlin's account, again from episode 59 of Military Tales, it just offers such a unique window into this largely untold chapter of the Vietnam War, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Task Force Alpha, this blend of almost futuristic technology for its time, combined with intense human analysis and interpretation, all focused on trying to unravel the secrets of the Ho Chi Minh Trail.
And some of those details are just unforgettable, aren't they? The blindfolded pilot story, whether literal or not, that incredible sounding war room.
Yeah, the Star Wars comparison really sticks. And the sheer scale, thousands of sensors, the $1 billion cost, it paints a picture of an immense hidden effort.
So as you, our listener, reflect on this deep dive, think about that hidden side of warfare, the intelligence battles, the technological race, the political pressures that Umlin's story hints at.
What does it reveal about the balance between gathering intelligence and the complex realities of using it during wartime? It raises some big questions.
Definitely. We really encourage you, if this has intrigued you, to seek out that source material, episode 59 of Military Tales on YouTube, and hear Steve Umlin tell his story in his own words. It's a fascinating piece of history.